Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Welcome to University Drive. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy, and today we're delving into the fascinating and complex topic, Caribbean space and place. When you think of the Caribbean, we often picture stunning scenic coastlines and beaches, vibrant, exciting cultures, warm, inviting climates, and tourism. We in the Bahamas are blessed by geography and nature. But have you ever considered how space, our land, our cities, our communities, not only shaped by who we are and what opportunities we have, but are they being remapped and re-engineered into something different? We're going to talk about it all today. Joining us to unpack these ideas are two scholars from University of the Bahamas who collaborated on research entitled loosely, Caribbean Place in Spaces, Exploring Spatial Identity. Professor Dr. Ian Bethel-Bennett and Professor Ms. Jessica Minnis, welcome and thank you for joining us again.
Thank you very much for having us, Ms. Lundy. We are grateful to be here.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Oh, call me Tamika. We all know each other pretty well here. And I'm sure by the time we get further along in our conversation, we will be so free and flowing, we won't have time for formal titles. What brought you to this kind of research? Is this something new? Is this a continuation? What brought both of you to this point?
I'm sure Jessica's going to throw me under the bus and tell me it's my fault.
Yes, it is.
Because you worked together before, right?
Yes, we did. We worked on two projects, both with Sophia Rowe on tourism, and then one with after the pandemic, looking at the way tourism had changed in the pandemic and after. But something that really struck me is the way space is very colonized, so it's designed into being. And I brought this to Jessica, and she was not impressed. So she has stated me in the bad books for many days now that I made her work on this project that looks at place and space and the ways that place and space are being captured and removed from the people that inhabit them, really.
Yeah, and again, when he did bring me on, because we had initially, I had gone to him to talk about looking at race relations in the Bahamas, and then he expanded it to look at that kind of space and place that encompasses so much more than that. And so, yeah, he brought me on. And so we're looking at, to add on to what Ian is saying, is the fact that we're looking at, we live in a paradise, or we are perceived as a paradise, but when people come, they don't realize that there is a life, that people, we don't go on the beach all the time, that we have to work. And our lives are centered around what we're doing. And so the perception of what outside the sea of us and how we see ourselves and the experiences that we have living in, actually we expanded it to the Caribbean. The things that individuals experience living in the Caribbean is so different from individuals who've just come to visit. So we wanted to show, well, actually the papers actually brought out the fact that the life of the Caribbean is not all sun, sand, and sea, that there is, and as Ian says, that we are being influenced to some extent from the outside. And so this is what got us into or what got me into it. And so it is really an exciting topic because we get to see how other people view their living spaces within the Caribbean, not just in the Bahamas, but elsewhere as well. So it was a good mix of topics and a good mix of views of space and place in the Caribbean. But similarities, differences, but similarities as well.
Yeah, it was a really deep peeling back of the layers. Exposes a lot of paradoxes, and it seemed to me to be a very deeply reflective research that takes a probing look at some of the things that we see every day, but might not necessarily piece them together in a coherent way to see the bigger picture, the commercialization of ports, the role of transnational organizations, access to coastlines and beaches, access to quality food, even, right? Take us into how all this begs for further exploration.
So I want to start with something that happened when I was in Guadeloupe, because Guadeloupe used to be it's French Caribbean and minorly developed compared to Martinique. And what we started to see after the labor strikes of about 2008, 9, 10 was a shifting demographic and a very intentional shift that became apparent years later. And the French authorities had encouraged French people from particular parts of France to migrate to Guadeloupe, thereby changing the entire ethnic and racial ethnic, but also class makeup and the political geography of the island. And that allowed tourism to shift its complexion on the island. And that allowed the development to really be transformed. And then we started to see that across the Caribbean, so in Puerto Rico, in the Bahamas. And more recently, we've seen this in the Pacific Islands, where people have been protesting the French coming in and taking over the space because before it was voting and development was reserved for people of that island. And I'm not going to call the island's name. But then the French legislation changed it to ensure that French citizens who moved to this place could now vote and thereby influence the entirety of the economic and political makeup of the island. And so what we saw that dynamically happening in Puerto Rico, we see it now in the Bahamas and in Guadeloupe.
Tell me, what was the scope of your research? How many Caribbean nations did you look at?
We looked at quite a few. I mean, there were a lot of people that came in, but we started looking at the ways cruise ports, for example, have basically sanitized their space and control access. So if you're not on the cruise ship in Barbados, say, you can't really access the cruise port. In the Bahamas, it's slightly different for various reasons. We looked at Puerto Rico, Guadeloupe, Jamaica, Barbados.
We have the Bahamas for sure. We have Guadeloupe. We have Martinique. No, Saint Martin actually, and we have Trinidad and Tobago. Contributions of different authors from those particular regions. So it is a broad spectrum. We also have that looked at the islands in the just off Panama, and so they're talking about their space and how it has changed because of migration and what the government is doing, telling them because of sea level rise that they have to move from their islands onto the mainland. And so it's an upsetting of their space, and they're not how do you move since you've been living there for so long? And then it's going back And also recognizing when they move to Colombia or they move to Panama, they recognize the language, they recognize that, oh, I can understand these individuals. And so it helps them to give them a sense of place and community as well, because they recognize other individuals who share the same cultural background as themselves. So we have individuals that look at that, and then we've also have one looking at using literature to talk about migration. People who move from Trinidad to America and then to Canada, and that whole diasporic movement and what it means in terms of gender, how do they connect to the land that they left? So he's trying to come back and understand where they originated and to see the connections between how they move from one area to the other and how they can adjust and what they do to maintain that culture within the dominant culture in which they live, such as Canada. So it's very interesting to see how people connect and why they connect when they move to another place, and how they also want to make that tie to the homeland, because it's also a part of their identity, and that's very key for them to be able to maintain that connection in a space that they also have to maintain, and they also have to blend to fit into a new environment. It's a cross section of looking at identity, and it's also the fact of what is real, how we perceive the life, how we are perceived from outside, and how we're saying that these are the issues that we have to deal with, because we live in an environment. So it is not as laid back as the image is portrayed by media, and the fact that this is the reality is that we still have issues of crime. We still have issues of identity in order to deal with. We still have religious differences that we have to deal with. And then of course it's the being able to have access to certain parts of your islands that are marked off for tourist attractions only or tourist enclaves only. And so some people, just like most countries, are beginning to feel that they're not, they're aliens in their own land, because everything is geared towards the tourist or the second home owner at the expense of the locals who were there. Some places have police guards on the beach to tell the tourists that, that they're safe and that locals can't come. So that is also something that, they are, or when they go into a hotel, they can only go in certain areas of the hotel, because most of this is for tourism, and for the tourist only. So we get to see, make a comparison between what is happening on the ground with people in their spaces. And we're also looking at gender too, how certain genders are treated within the society, how much access they have. There is a paper about looking at transgender in the Bahamas and how, again, the perception is that they're being erased from and not having access to certain benefits that the average citizen would have. And so they're showing the points of, and they have to leave in order to feel comfortable, in order to be able to be themselves and to have that identity. They have to leave and go to another place that is more receptive of their identity, and that they can have an identity.
Yeah, one of the initial contributors was from Cuba, and it was interesting that we don't perceive these challenges as happening in Cuba, but the initial chapter that was submitted by them showed that this was happening in Cuba as well because of the duality of the spatial relations. Cubans can go one place and tourists can go to another, but unfortunately they did not complete the topic, the chapter, so we had to leave that one. But it was really an intriguing aspect, because you think of Cuba as being so distinct from the rest of us who were suffering transnationalism, post neoliberal realities, really, where, as David Harvey talks about, the Disneyfication of the world, where we all start to look alike, but we don't necessarily have access to those spaces anymore.
So what were
Yeah.
you both seeking to uncover, and then what did you actually find? Because the Caribbean is a very wide region with a lot of different cultures and ethnicities and nationalities. It would be interesting to see what's the thread that's running throughout all of the different geographies, if I could use that word.
I think it's dispossession. Feeling like as the Calypso song that we used by Alien, by Mighty Rep, a St. Lucian resident, and he says all-inclusive tax ex inclusives. Then truth is they're sucking up reduces, buying up every strip of beach, every spot they reach. And it's an exclusive vandals. It's a scandal the way they operate, building brick walls and barricades, like state within a state. So I think for some within the Caribbean, they're looking at it as being dispossessed of some lands or access to lands. And as the other verse he says, I, like an alien and we own land, I feel like a stranger and I'm sensing danger. We for pollutions to enter for lunch or dinner, we need reservations, passport, and visa. And if you sell near the hotel, then you know they bar you from these kinds of things. So the thread running about it is how they perceive, how we perceive the use of space. It's the same thing. One of the chapters also looked at religion in space and women not having, again, their not having a particular space. They can do everything, but they couldn't run a church. And they were talking about the Catholic Church, that they couldn't run, they couldn't be head of a church. They couldn't be a priest in a pastor, a priest in a church because they were women. But they were saying that they were capable of doing everything else. But because they were females and, you know, they were, the scriptures were used to justify, not giving women high prominence in the church. And so we get to see even within religion, certain religions, that there was some again inequalities in the church and women not being identified solely with within the top echelons. So it's similar to that. And it's the same thing with education and class. Women are when we look at the different occupations, some talked about the judicial system and how, again, women were not in top positions. They even in corporations, they were not in top positions, although they were qualified because of, again, how they are perceived, or what their identity is, and how they're perceived in their society. So we also get to see not only is it in tourism or the economy, but you also get to see it in other aspects of society as well, where there is space that is allocated for a certain group of individuals, and how that is carried out within the society. But that's the common thread throughout the papers.
Ian, you have something to say about along the lines of dispossession that Jessica mentioned, because you wrote in the research that, and I quote, the people who identify this place as home are now out of place. I'd like you to explain that for me, and for me, that's striking when you think about current reality and our brutal history of rejection from where we as a people originated, right? But explain that for me.
Great point. When I started this a few years ago, it was very basic looking at the ways we are being dispossessed through the coloniality of culture, the coloniality of law, and the coloniality of space. Because coloniality is really a tool that has been used and continues to be used, even though it's post-colonial. A lot of the people who are invested in the development of the of nationalism and the nation state have found that they are actually not included in the discussion and not included in the mapping or the remapping of spaces. And I use an example in Puerto Rico, where in the neighborhood I lived for many years, the working class people were very slowly and systematically moved out. And the government had a project to make a boutique city for people to come and spend time in. And one of the developers of a different aspect of it says, if you can't afford to come and own in it, but you can only afford to have a limber, and a limber is like a local candy, bueno, such is life. And it really resonated with a lot of people, and you started to see projects developing around trying to control the community and the way the government was dis or pushing those poorer communities off land. And they had there was one in that Puerta de Tierra that looked at aquí vive gente, people live here, as in recognize our humanity, recognize that we are people, and please just stop stepping on us, stepping over us. And what has happened since then is that the hedge funders and the developers, the big bankers have come in and moved all those people out. So they have been dispossessed, and they have also been erased from the landscape. So in my more recent work, Saskia Sassin, who's a sociologist, looks at it as we have been ex kicked out. It's like an expulsion because we're no longer counted in the numbers. We are also no longer counted in terms of unemployed. We're no longer counted in terms of residents. We don't count. We have become voiceless. We've become invisible. And we see that a great deal in very different ways, in very interesting, nuanced ways in the Bahamas, in Puerto Rico, and in Guadeloupe, as I was saying. So there's a definite transnationalizing of the space that takes it out of the nation space and moves it into a non-place, or what Mark Ohr calls a non-place, where it's like an airport. You can come through, you feel comfortable, but you're never allowed to reside. There is no identity, as we talk about. So you have a real class race difference happening.
All great points. We're only scratching the surface right now of how space and place affect Caribbean life. We're talking to researchers, professors Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett and Ms. Jessica Minnis. Stay tuned. This is University 5. We'll have more after this break.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
Welcome back to University Drive. We are discussing Caribbean space and place with researchers, professors Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett and Ms. Jessica Minnis. And so one of the research areas or themes that you've explored in your latest research relates to spatial inequality. Give us some examples of how this plays out in the Bahamas and the wider Caribbean.
In essence, the inequality comes in, let's just take the environment. There was a paper that looks at the impact of climate change on the Caribbean, especially in small island states. And we are told, you know, that the Caribbean and the Bahamas is one of those places that we're going to be impacted by sea level rise. And of course, we're one of the ones who are not really contributing much to it, but we are the ones that are suffering. Will be suffering the most because of that. And so how do we deal with it? And we have to deal with it in the context of identity. Do we change our identity because we might have to move? What does that mean for us? Where do we go? And the other is, and they associate that with trauma. When we, you know, when you're traumatized by something, you want to put it in the back of your mind until the next one comes, and then it comes back to the forefront. And then how do we deal with it? And so it's a matter by which we try to find ways to cope with this. And in our daily lives, we know that the big one is coming, but we don't know when, but we can't be paralyzed. We still have to live. But at the same time, how do we cope with what should we be doing? And of course, the other is we're a tourist destination, and how is that going to impact us? Because, you know, our waters, that's one of the ways that we that we attract tourists because of our beautiful waters. But if there is coral bleaching and if there is the heating up of the oceans, then what is that going to mean for us? How do we identify with that? So the environment, and then of course the other paper that comes out of Jamaica focuses on Jamaica, the uglification of Jamaica. They're talking about industries like the bauxite industry and the cutting down of the forest for industry, and but that at the same time you are talking about tourism and hotels, and so you know. The same thing that you are advocating to keep it nice and to be representative, but at the same time, you are using that space and destroying that space, cutting down trees or vegetation for tourism. But then you're also bringing in, you're replacing it with something that is from the outside. How do you balance both? And that has to be kept in mind when we start to think about development, in whose favor is the development? And especially if you're a tourist destination, you're a small island state, there has to be a symbiotic relationship where you don't necessarily are destroying both if it's possible, at the expense of the other. So the environment is also, and it's usually your the coast and people who might not have access to the coast because most of our tourist development takes place on coastal areas. And so you are now also cutting off to some extent the population from having access or making also enjoying something that we cater for the tourists. But so the environment in two fronts. What happens to the identity when we move? Should we have to move? Also, how if it is destroyed by some natural disaster, what does that do for a person's identity? And also, how do we cope with that? And so that's where the inequalities can also come in there. We've also addressed issues of gender inequalities as a in terms of looking at the violence that is there that is perpetrated.
One of the challenges with that, looking at violence, is that the inequities in space means that the unequal places are developed along these lines where impoverished people are allowed to live. And we find that these are the spaces where more violence is prevalent, or where violence is prevalent. And we look at different kinds of violence. And the violence is in response to the structural violence of racism and dispossession, but also to the systemic systemic violence of daily discrimination and how the dispossession, the disenfranchisement, and the disaffection create violence in the home and create interpersonal violence between men and men and men and women, so that these relations then spill over into the entire community. So you're looking at increased violence, but also very, very deep violence within the home spaces, where we always say, you know, home space is meant to be safe. And looking at Miriam Chauncey's work from in the 90s, where women's writing is about home and safety, and home actually being a place where you are afraid, where you will face danger because of intimate partner violence that stems from a huge inequity in the social structure. And one of the frames that comes to mind is Orlando Patterson's work on slavery and social death, where he refers to slavery as a form of social death when it comes to killing the way the community can develop. What we see now is that it's not just slavery, but it's also the dispossession that is a social death, because it kills the community. And those communal transformations happen very slowly and very subtly, but in ways that absolutely undermine the social structures that exist in very old, very traditional, but also very communal communities. And when I say communal communities, I mean these communities where people helped other people. When the generations either leave, they're evicted, or they die, and the space changes, that community fabric dissolves, it disappears. It cannot stand up to the post-neoliberal age of transnationalism. And that's something that's important.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that these matters that relate to identity are not hardly discussed in national commentary or around the dinner table. How do we break down all of the information that you are uncovering in the barest components of impact and consequences, so that we are able to preserve and protect and grow more harmoniously and naturally and wholesomely as distinct and different communities across the Caribbean? And I know that that question might be loaded, but I'm trying to say, how do we use this information to make ourselves better?
I want to say, I just came out of a class where we were discussing how one does ethnographic work and how one does field work at the end of the term, and looking at the ways we use sources to build upon that. I want to use the example of the Reinhardt Hotel over the hill, and how its collapse was not just about a place collapsing. It was about the stories and the memories held within that place collapsing and being erased. Because as soon as that collapsed, and we knew it was being undermined, it was plowed down, it was erased, and a car park was put up or put in. So, and you know, it was chain linked. So you have this ring fencing around these spaces that would have historically been black spaces that have now been associated with violence and poverty, but were always about blackness and resistance to colonialism, and have just been erased. Watching students grapple with this and understand that tourism is not so much about the tourist hotel. The hotel has been replaced by a resort, and the resort is now no longer about entertainment. It is about ownership, and it's about making money. It's about creating wealth for hedge fund people management companies, wealth investors. So the connections to any local entity is gone. And we see that in Puerto Rico, we see that in Guadeloupe, we see that in the Bahamas. We also see that in St. Martin. And we suddenly see that in Miami because the whole pattern of development has changed and the traditional communities are being wiped out.
What are some of the things that, going in, you might have your points of view, even though you need to kind of be objective as a researcher as you continue to peel back more layers and uncover more information. Was there anything that kind of caught you by surprise as you continue to conduct your research, both of you?
Not really. It just shows the fact that it comes in different forms. You think of one way and then something else comes up. So we recognize that it is very complex and that there are certain things that once we recognize it, that there can be some changes that can be made. And we hope that through this book that or this publication that people will get to see and be a little bit more observant of what's happening around them, and through then you could make the changes. Not that we're not saying that it's negative or anything, but it's just that these are events that are happening, and once we are aware, then hopefully that changes will be made. And so that's for me is what I find, and we are sharing similar ideas and similar experiences in the different Caribbean islands, and so that to me is so we're not isolated, we're not in a vacuum, but these are some of the things that other islands are experiencing, and we're sharing that to know that we're not alone in this, and we can also look to see what other islands have done in order to deal with. Or to cope with some of the issues that are plaguing us all. Because then we recognize that we share as small island states, because the Bahamas is not, the Caribbean is not the only one. Any small island states in the Pacific are also going through the same kinds of changes and experiences that we are going through as well. So it lets us know how do we deal with it. We can see what one island did, maybe we can apply that to us. And so, it's a sharing of information. I'll give you an example too. It was interesting because something was written, a student had come back from abroad and they had made a comment about food stores. And I'm saying, but Ian wrote, we wrote a paper, there is a paper about image and food deserts and how the different areas are treated differently depending on where you fall. And so, why couldn't we? It couldn't be uniform throughout. It's the same company, but depending on the neighborhood in which you're in, the structures are different. The produce is different, and why? And we understand why, but and then of course it comes at the expense of the mom and pop shops that when everybody went into. So as we become gentrified, then those little stores have to, we tend to move to the bigger stores because they have more offerings. And so the mom and pop shops, they're there, but we don't patronize them as much as because we can go to a food store and we can get all the things that are there, but they're not all equal.
And Ian, anything caught you by surprise or pretty much affirmed what you had suspected?
I think I was caught by surprise by the level of green gentrification that has happened. I didn't think of it as being so profoundly changing as I saw it after Hurricane Maria, well, Hurricanes Irma and Maria in Puerto Rico, and the loss of cultural space. And then looking at the way Ragged Island was dealt with, and then Dorian almost immediately after. And there's always this statement, we could not have known this was going to happen, but we did know. We were warned by this happening elsewhere. that this was going to happen, and the ways that the laws have been used to remove people. Once they leave, the law kicks in to keep them out, to keep them gone. So in Barbuda, how people were being pushed out, rescued, but then not allowed to return, and they were only allowed to return temporarily once the government had changed the law, basically dispossessing them of communal ownership of the land. And communal is really important in that, because that was a colonial structure that came out of post-slavery or post-emancipation realities. And that really struck me. And then watching it happen in Dorian, and watching people be approached to sell their homes because they couldn't afford to rebuild, or be leveraged out of the community, and designs happening without people knowing in different places, so that a new kind of space was being engineered as people were trying to recover. Or because they were in such shock and disheveled, there was this ability to take advantage of the moment, and just watching it repeat itself across the entirety of the region. And of course, it's not just the region. It's looking at New Orleans after Katrina and all these other places.
So now, with all you've shared, what is the role of our universities in this moment? What is the role of University of the Bahamas in terms of thought leadership, action, guidance on policy? Where do our university, what role should they be playing?
I think the university plays a great role in this, and we have faculty members in different areas who address most of these issues, and they've written chapters, presently, and they've written chapters about it, and they've presented about this. So it is, but the thing is that we have to make sure that the powers that be recognize what is being done here, and also to pay a little bit more attention to what we are having to say is, and to be able to use the information that we have that is being generated by faculty to be able to inform policy. So I think it can also be used to generate research in these specific areas that are required. But we know that we do have a role to play, and the faculty are doing it in so many different ways that sometimes it falls under the radar. But we just need to make sure that the powers that be recognize us for the work that is being done, and to be able to incorporate it in most of their decision making. And when they make laws or they make policy or when they go out abroad, they know that the work is being done. And this is what researchers on campus are finding. So it's just a matter of them recognizing us a little bit more and tapping into what we are doing first and foremost before you go outside. If you have any information on this and how can we use that, I think that would be certainly a plus for us because faculty are doing their research, they are doing these things. But it's just that somehow it doesn't get where it should really go.
Because as you're talking, I'm thinking about how this information has implications for things like national development planning and visioning, doesn't it?
Yes.
It does, yeah.
It does.
The thing about doing the research is that it takes a while. Publications take a while. It doesn't just happen in a month or two. It takes years for development to happen with a project, and the project needs to be supported throughout that time. I mean, the research. So Franklin Wilson and those are doing a good job in supporting research, It's just that we need to kind of figure out how the university can become much more research friendly and less teaching heavy. And that way, inform more of the national development of the country, that which is what we do. When I was at University of Puerto Rico, it was interesting to see how the law school was really important in creating policy within that ecosystem. And then when the government shifted that, a lot of things changed and people moved from the University of Puerto Rico to a different university that could fill that void, so to speak. Universities are really important in making these things happen, in developing citizens that are, informed, aware, able to discuss, not just discuss informally, but are able to bring things to the fore that are important. I think one of the challenges that we face as well is that we are an archipelago. So, as an archipelagic nation, it takes a lot longer and a lot more to get around. It's a similar reality in Puerto Rico, where there are different islands that make up the nation of Puerto Rico, because it is a nation. So the re people have to move from Vieques to the mainland of Puerto Rico to get medical care. This is the same problem here. And each time they come, they have to pay for the air travel, they have to pay to stay, and they have to then pay for food because they're not at home. And we don't take any of this into consideration when we design our services. We just do it without thinking of out island residents. And then other people will say, well, why don't you move everybody off those islands? Because then you are killing a form of Bahamian history, geography, sociology, and culture.
Very good place to take our last break of the show. You're listening to University Drive. We'll have more compelling conversation after these messages.
Are you ready to take your knowledge or career to new heights? Don't wait to invest in your future. Do it now. How? Earn a professional development certificate from University of the Bahamas. Whether you're looking to enhance your leadership abilities, sharpen your technical skills, or explore a new field entirely, our Continuing Education and Lifelong Learning Center has the ideal course for you. We offer single-phase electrical, ethics in procurement, accounting for entrepreneurship, stop managing, start leading, dynamic presentations, digital marketing, superior customer service, and justice of the peace. We even have courses on smartphone photography, TikTok videos, defensive driving, and interacting with difficult people. Or open the door to new languages with English as a second language, conversational Chinese, and Spanish in the workplace. Our instructors are experts in their fields, and they're here to support you every step of the way. Call us at 302-4449. Enroll today.
Welcome back to University Drive. This is our final segment of the show. We are talking about space and place in the Caribbean. You know, the Caribbean is deeply connected to migration. People leave, come back for economic opportunities and other pull and push factors, and others return. How does migration reshape our spaces?
It's very important. Because we migrate for so many different reasons. We migrate because your parents are moving. We migrate because you're looking for a better standard of living, or you're looking for employment opportunities elsewhere. And what we found is that also when they migrate, they might be anywhere in the world, but they always say they're going to come. They always keep one foot back in the Caribbean. So yeah, they might be living in Canada, or they might be living in Europe, but there is always that affinity to home. Caribbean will, the Caribbean will always be home. And so you take the Caribbean with you, and you set up an area that is similar to home. And so that allows you to adjust, also to adjust to a new environment that is different from yourself. And you also want to let them know that, yes, you live in, let's just say you're in Canada, but you still have a culture, and you have a different ethnic work background than the person who lives there. And so you want them to know that, yes, I am from there, but I have a culture and I'm proud of that, but I can also adjust within that environment, and I can do the same things that you expect of your locals. I can do the same thing as well. So that is, and it's interesting, we might be different in the Caribbean. We might be Trinidadian or Bahamian, but when we get to another place, we come together, we unite, and we recognize that we have some things in common. We might be different, but we also have some things in common. And so you forge that Caribbean community once you get, so you get to see that with Caribana in Toronto, or you get to see that in Nottingham in England, that Caribbean is, and they also do the same thing with in New Zealand, in Australia, is either Australia or New Zealand, where there is a strong West Indian presence, and that carnival becomes a part of their identity. And they also, they're very proud to know that they have that. So the same things that they might do in the region, they certainly make themselves to be distinct and something to be recognized by, and something that they're proud, and that gives them the affinity, the connection. They're not there, but they have that connection with their home territory, their home island. Yeah, very
And I
proud
want to,
of being there.
build on it in slightly differently in terms of the internal and external migration. So you have internal migration within the country where we move from place to place or space to space, and we either build up a community or we kill it, because people leave that community, it falls into disrepair. I find that one of the documented places where this has happened is Crooked Island, because it's so depopulated. And then if I go to Puerto Rico, the design that the government put in place at a particular point in time killed a small town. And that has had consequences on everybody. I mean, I try to do a lot of photo documentary of how spaces are killed by legal and other forms causing migration. And then when we look at London, because London is one of those massive cities where migration, we know, we think of migration in a particular way of Caribbean migrants moving to London, but we don't think of Caribbean migrants or Caribbean persons then being kicked out by the ways that the laws change to dispossess them afterwards. One example of that is the Windrush generation, where so many Caribbean folk were suddenly sent back to Jamaica after having lived in London an entire lifetime, because apparently they were never naturalized or normalized. And then in their stead, you have Russians who were moving into London, buying up large swaths of land and or swathes, taking it over and gentrifying it so that not even the people who are wealthy within that space can afford to live there, and then leaving. So it kills us, the community, but it also changes the demographic. And then again, looking, there's a great book in Puerto Rico, in Puerto Rican literature, called La Carreta, the ox cart, that explores migration from the country to San Juan, to the city, or La Perla, the outskirts of San Juan, which is a regularized community at the foot of, on the coastal side of San Juan, to New York, because of everybody trying to get a better life, and the identity shifts that happen, and the spatial transformations, and then always wishing to go back and never being able to because back there no longer exists. The home is gone, the land is gone, the reality has catapulted into a different sphere. So these are really important things that I think we are just seeing, as in Guadeloupe as well, where entire communities are being shifted because of a very intentional policy to get rid of them, to move them, to destabilize them by a movement that would empower a particular complexion of person and a political persuasion that we have not investigated sufficiently.
In such a range of complexities, but it's worth paying attention to deeply and in a researched way, isn't it?
But yeah, it is. It is. I mean, the political transformation of Guadeloupe from a very radically Guadeloupean place to a radically right-wing French space is hallucinating.
So I'm going to ask what may seem like an odd question. Based on everything you know now, having researched this, what are the conversations that we should be having around the dinner table, on culture, on forces like globalization and transnationalism, equity and equality and access? Because I mean, at the most basic level, all of at the root of all of these things, as I see it, is human nature. Right. So, what are the conversations we should be having?
I think one of the conversations we need to have is much more about Bahamian history and about Bahamian social realities. Like, I realize that there has been no transfer of knowledge between most generations within general groups of people, which is shocking because I thought that people had been so impassioned by their history that they would pass it on to their kids. But that's not the case. And I find one of the other challenges is when things like cemeteries or graveyards are lost, church communities, that is the end of the memory. That is the violent eruption or rupture with that past. Because you don't just live there, you die there. And in death, there is a huge import within the space, and we are not discussing those. We see more discussions around that in other Caribbean places, but not in the Bahamas. Death practices are never talked about, it seems.
So, are we doing enough to define and perpetuate and preserve our identity as Bahamians?
We're just now doing it. I think we're doing it now. For the individuals who are there, but we are also challenged by our neighbors to the north who are bigger than us, who have more finances and who've been established a little bit longer than we have. So we're trying to play catch up. And we tend to think that that neighbor or the two neighbors were whoever they may be, that is more significant than we are. But we also have a very important cultural traditions that we also need to maintain.
Yeah, and as a social historian, like that's really important, documenting those stories, getting people to tell their stories. Yeah, it's not like it's a formal interview, it's just letting them talk and listening and hearing what they're saying and then documenting that
And also building on it.
and building on it, yeah.
And building on it, you don't dismiss. You can build on it. That becomes the starting point for so many other things.
Okay, so in our final 2 minutes of the show, Tell us how we can access and read all about your research.
We're hoping that the book comes out very soon. It's going to take a little bit to get the final touches done. It is being published with Bergen Press, which initially was the press on place and space. And yeah, it's the research is ongoing. So where I am looking at different aspects of place development now, and I think Jessica is as well, and how class and race really inform where people are, or where people fit in place in spatial justice.
And so we can get to under once we get to understand that and know that it isn't a simple fix, it isn't a simple solution, that it is basically complex because you're dealing with other individuals who have different ideas, but you can bring them all together and come up with something, a general consensus.
All right, what a wonderful discussion we've had over this hour. Thank you so much, Professor Jessica Minnis and Professor Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett, for joining us here on University Drive. Thank you also to our listeners. I've been your host, Tamika Lundy, for this episode. Join us again next week, same time, same place. Take care for now.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.